A baseball game, a day in a park with friends and family, fishing in a remote stream, work, travels, providing for loved ones, or heading out for adventures. Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. The original Guide to Men's Health is presented by the Washington State Urology Society to help take you through the steps necessary to get the most out of life. If you have invested in a retirement plan for your future, why not invest in your body? After all, it makes better sense to retire healthy and enjoy your future. These podcasts are a guide for how to take care of yourself. If you take care of your car and maintain it, why not do the same for your personal machine, your body? If you know you should but haven't yet, the information in these podcasts contains some easy recommendations for where, when, and how to get started. Follow the podcast as we explore men's health with renowned experts and embark on a journey towards better health. On this episode of the original Guide to Men's Health, we are going to be exploring common diabetic and endocrine disorders with Dr. Aarti Thirumalai. Dr. Thirumalai is an assistant professor of medicine, Division of Endocrinology, here at the University of Washington School of Medicine. She did her residency and fellowship in endocrinology at the University of Washington, and has research interests in andrology and male contraception. Clinically, she sees a variety of endocrine disorders and diabetes. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with the common endocrine issue, diabetes, and maybe even go before that into what's called prediabetes, metabolic syndrome, Syndrome X.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so given what everybody is aware of, the obesity epidemic, what we're seeing is rapidly increasing numbers of individuals with this entity called metabolic syndrome. This condition is defined mainly by the presence of three or more of the following problems. The first feature being increase in abdominal circumference, so waist circumference that is more than certain set parameters. Rise in blood pressure, typically we think of numbers that are over about 130 over 85. Rise in fasting blood glucose over 100 milligrams per deciliter. And then cholesterol abnormalities that could either be triglycerides that are getting elevated over 150 milligrams per deciliter, or an HDL that's falling under certain parameters for men and women, those numbers being different. So when somebody has more than three of these, we consider them as having metabolic syndrome. And just looking at those individual components, we know that all of those are risk factors for heart disease. And so we pay more attention to these individuals and try to modify these risk factors earlier so that it doesn't evolve into diabetes and it doesn't evolve into heart disease.
Let's say we have a patient who has not entered into the healthcare system. They're listening to this and they go, well, I guess I could go get my blood pressure taken. I would have to go to a lab and have somebody order the blood work. Anything else that might give them an idea that they're heading in that direction?
Well, you know, everybody has a sense of how much they weigh. And if you feel like you are an unhealthy weight or borderline overweight, then those are definitely the people that I would target more specifically to go meet with a primary care doctor, get your weight checked, figure out what your body mass index is, and are you at risk for any of these problems? As you mentioned, screening blood pressure is actually recommended for all adults over the age of 18, which is really the definition of adulthood. And then even screening for diabetes is recommended in anybody over the age of 40, especially if they're overweight or obese. And the screening for diabetes has become a lot simpler than it used to be. Originally, people might have thought you need to do this thing where you take a glucose load and then do a measurement at 1 hour, 2 hours. But it's not as complicated as that anymore. A simple test called a hemoglobin A1C on your blood on a random draw, you don't need to fast, could be a starting point to see if you might have prediabetes or diabetes.
So for somebody who gets their blood drawn and has a normal fasting glucose or blood sugar, but has an abnormal hemoglobin A1C, is that possible?
It is possible because prediabetes is essentially defined as somewhere between normal and diabetes. And there are two components to that. One is called impaired fasting glucose, and the other is called impaired glucose tolerance. And the problem with the two is a little different. In impaired fasting glucose, the main problem is that the liver is responsible for making extra glucose in the body, and it's doing too much of that. And so they may be fine when they eat, and their glucose may be normal, but when they wake up in the morning, their blood sugar is high. Whereas in impaired glucose tolerance, what ends up happening is that they're not able to dispose of the glucose that is absorbed from any food that they eat in the proper way. And so the word prediabetes really encompasses both of these problems. They could either have one of the two abnormal or both of them abnormal, just not abnormal enough to call it diabetes. So you could have a normal fasting glucose, but still be prediabetic because your glucose tolerance is impaired.
So again, we're talking about prediabetes or this metabolic syndrome. If left unchecked, what happens?
About a third of them will progress to diabetes. And actually, the numbers have been skyrocketing as the times have gone by. And if you look at the CDC data, comparing 20 years ago to now, the rates of prediabetes have gone up and the rates of diabetes have also gone up. What's actually even more interesting is that men are more likely to have undiagnosed diabetes or undiagnosed prediabetes compared to women. I think women tend to encounter or interact with the medical system more often just by reproductive needs. And so they get diagnosed earlier. Women tend to have other symptoms that they might seek help for earlier than men do. So I think this is definitely something important for men in the early adulthood, 18 to 30, 30 to 49, to consider, whereas older men tend to seek medical help more often, so are less likely to get missed.
And then somebody, again, maybe pre-diabetic, not getting treated, not turning into full-blown diabetes. So they're in the other, what you said, two-thirds?
Yep.
They have high blood pressure, that's going to cause issues for them.
Exactly.
What other manifestations of the prediabetes can be problematic for them if it's not treated?
Well, so I think the thing that to focus more on is like, what are the associated risk factors? So somebody might have a genetic cholesterol problem that they're not aware of, and having prediabetes on top of a second risk factor puts them at higher risk for heart disease, and they may have an early heart attack or a stroke in their 40s or 50s that they might have otherwise prevented by seeking medical attention early. And the same goes if there's another risk factor like smoking or they're overweight, then multiple risk factors add up and put them at risk for more serious things.
Now, if they're not yet diabetic, we're still talking about prediabetes, they do seek care. What are some of the treatment options for these people?
Right. So in general, for most people with prediabetes, what will be offered is intense lifestyle modification. And that essentially includes what we consider appropriate exercise activity, which should be at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity or 75 minutes of vigorous activity per week, in addition to which they need to eat a healthy diet. The definition of that is a little tenuous, but in general, we recommend less than 10% of your daily caloric intake coming from refined sugars, less than 10% of the daily caloric intake being from saturated fats. And so leading a healthy lifestyle in terms of diet and exercise would be the first step that most people will try. Having said that, you don't need to stop there. You can also add medications. And the one that's usually offered is metformin therapy. It's a drug that's an oral medication. It's a tablet that it's been around for decades. And so there's no concern about safety at all. And it has been shown to very effectively prevent the progression from prediabetes to diabetes. And it can sometimes be a little difficult to tolerate side effects, but if you titrate the dose up slowly, most people do completely fine.
What sort of side effect would be concerning?
Most people experience a little bit of stomach discomfort. So they can get a little bloating, a little gassiness, some abdominal cramping, or even diarrhea. But usually we start at a very low dose and very gradually increase the dose. There's also extended release formulations of this drug that help circumvent those side effects. Those would be effective ways of preventing progression from prediabetes to diabetes.
And I remember reading something about metformin in a longevity study, that it might be the longevity drug.
Yes, and actually lots of studies are ongoing for anti-cancer effects of metformin as well. So I don't think we've exhausted all of the utilities of this drug yet, but definitely a very safe drug and very effective.
Yeah, I've had some patients who are concerned, oh, I have to go on this medicine. I said, well, it may not be bad.
Yes.
You actually might do better than the person next to you who's not taking it.
Correct. Some people will raise concerns that, oh, my kidney is going to be damaged by this drug. And I think that stems from some misinformation. There is a dose reduction that is recommended in people with kidney disease, but it does not cause kidney problems. So I just want to make sure that always when I'm talking to my patients that they understand the difference between dose adjustments for a medical problem versus it causing that problem.
So the lifestyle modification would include smoking cessation with somebody helping them do that, exercise, diet, and we might see blood pressure get better.
Absolutely.
Cholesterol drop.
Mm-hmm.
The risk for diabetes decrease.
Absolutely.
All through just
right.
Exercise.
And the other piece is alcohol consumption too, especially for people with diabetes, high triglycerides. A lot of the times the problem is alcohol intake. So we recommend safe limits, which is usually one drink per day at the most for women and not more than two drinks per day for men.
Amen. And of course, watching out those refined sugars.
Yes.
That, you know, they sneak in there.
Absolutely. So important to pay attention to packaging. And most packages will now have how much added sugar is there and how much sugars are there totally. So it's just important to pay attention to those.
So we want to control the issues with high blood pressure to prevent stroke and heart attack, improve cardiac function, longevity.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think you're at risk and you're listening to this, go get checked.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's move on to then diabetes, very common condition. And people get an idea that aren't there two forms of diabetes?
So that's actually a very good question. So there are more than two forms of diabetes, but there are two large buckets of diabetes. One is autoimmune diabetes, and the other is the form that's due to insulin resistance. There is a small third category that is not related to either of these two, but they're very rare. So most likely a physician will think about that if it applies in that situation. The first one, which is type 1 or the autoimmune diabetes, is due to autoantibodies that your immune system makes that then go and attack the beta cells, which are small cells inside the pancreas that are normally supposed to make insulin. And this used to be thought of as the juvenile version of diabetes, which children were diagnosed with. But what we're seeing more and more is that people can get diagnosed at any age with this condition. I have a patient who was diagnosed at the age of 52 with type 1 diabetes. But the point is that the mechanism is the destruction of the ability to make insulin. So these people don't make enough insulin of their own. And the primary treatment for this is with insulin. Type 2 diabetes, the problem is a little different. So the problem here is that they're making insulin, but the tissues that respond to insulin are not responding the right way. For example, the liver, the muscle, and the fat cells are the main tissues we think of as responding to insulin. And in terms of response, what they're really doing is taking up the glucose that you make from absorption of food and then disposing it in the right way. And if you're not able to dispose that glucose properly, your blood sugar goes up. And so this is considered a problem of insulin resistance. It is definitely linked to a great amount with obesity and being overweight. Having said that, there are several people who are obese but do not have diabetes. And there are several people who have severe insulin resistance but are not overweight. So it isn't an absolute connection, but there is definitely a correlation between the two.
Now, recognizing diabetes is important because of its effects on
heart disease and general health. Actually, heart disease is the thing that we worry the most about because diabetes is actually considered as equivalent to kidney disease or Alzheimer's in terms of overall risk of death. But it is the single biggest risk factor for heart disease, which is the leading cause of death. And so it's important to think about diabetes control from a heart disease perspective. But again, there's also other complications like kidney disease, chronic kidney disease. The main cause is diabetes. Complications in terms of nerve damage. So people get neuropathies and pain in their hands and feet. People can also get erectile dysfunction from neuropathy. And so diabetic neuropathy is one of the leading causes of erectile dysfunction in men. And then there's also retinal damage. So eye changes that can happen from diabetes. And so it's very important to control diabetes.
And the endothelial dysfunction, the small vessel dysfunction from diabetes that's not been checked and treated and run on causes and contributes to the erectile dysfunction besides the neuropathy. So good motivator for the guys if we want to maintain erections.
Yep, absolutely.
Get checked.
And we're also realizing more and more that diabetes contributes also to poor bone health. And this is, again, true for older men, because as you age, bone loss is a real thing. And men are not always going to get checked for bone loss or osteoporosis like women are. And so if they have uncontrolled diabetes or have lived with diabetes for several decades, it puts them at risk for osteoporosis as well.
So we spoke about the autoimmune and then insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. Now, somebody, before we go to treatment, who may be listening again, hasn't been good about going and getting checked, what symptoms might they have?
Right. And so type 1 diabetes very rarely presents sort of insidiously. It's usually associated with symptoms. The symptoms that they can experience are increased thirst, increased urination, increased appetite, and weight loss. So those are the ones we typically experience. People can also present with an acute infection and then get diagnosed with type 1 diabetes or just a severe crisis called diabetic ketoacidosis, where they end up in the hospital with a lot of nausea and vomiting and abdominal pain. Type 2 diabetes, on the other hand, can be very sneaky. It can be lingering for months and months or years even, where people have no symptoms at all. Sometimes people will ignore subtle symptoms like, oh, my vision got blurry after I ate that really big meal and then it went away. But those can be some subtle symptoms that people can experience. And also the nerve pain. Neuropathy can be something that can happen acutely and people will feel tingling or numbness in their feet or hands. That can get better and get worse over time. And so they might ignore it, but those would be symptoms to watch for and get screened for diabetes.
Yeah, so thirst, excessive urination that mm-hmm. comes on. Gee, why am I so thirsty all the time?
Yep.
Now, if somebody says, well, I go to my doctor once a year for a physical, we would assume that most people would have a hemoglobin A1C as a screening test?
I think so. Having said that, I have seen that not all primary care doctors will utilize a hemoglobin A1C. A lot of them will do the fasting glucose. I think if your fasting glucose is completely normal, it's reasonable if you don't have a strong family history of diabetes to just use that test. But if you have a strong family history of type 2 diabetes or the fasting glucose is creeping up over time and it's very close to that 100 mark, that you should really get screened with a hemoglobin A1C. The other group of people that I would recommend a hemoglobin A1C is, you know, people who have other medical problems like thyroid disease or, you know, kidney disease, and where you might be missing the picture with just that one glucose measurement. So you just want to make sure that you're checking everything.
And so then someone is diagnosed. What are the treatment options for them?
So the world of type 1 diabetes or autoimmune diabetes is still largely insulin dependent. So most people will only be treated with insulin in their entire lifetime. There is a role of some of the other newer agents, but it's really not FDA approved yet. And so it's more exploratory in terms of treatment. In type 2 diabetes, on the other hand, we've gone from metformin, a couple of drugs called like glipizide, glimepiride, and insulin to 15 new drugs getting added in the last 15 years or so. So there's a lot of newer medications, the focus being either weight reduction or reduction of cardiovascular disease or prevention of progression of chronic kidney disease. So there are a lot of new medications, and typically what a doctor will do is start you, as I said, on lifestyle modification and metformin therapy. And if you're unable to achieve your target glucose control with that, then they will add on a second agent, which can be any one of a category of drugs called SGLT2 inhibitors, which are drugs like Jardiance, Farxiga, or Invokana, or the injectable drugs like GLP-1 receptor agonists, which go by the names of Victoza, Trulicity, or Ozempic. And sometimes in some select individuals, they might add glipizide or glimepiride or pioglitazone. Those three drugs are less used in patients who can afford the other medications because they do unfortunately come with the side effect of weight gain, but they're definitely very cost efficient. And so for people in whom that is a factor, those would be the second line agent. Adding all of these does not effectively control somebody's glucose. That's when we resort to insulin. And insulin comes in two forms. One is a long acting injection where you only inject it once a day. And then there's short acting versions, which you have to inject every time you're eating. And that would sort of be the last step in the management of type 2 diabetes.
Has data shown that if you treat the diabetes, you can reverse the conditions or you just stop them from progressing?
That's a terrific question. So that, I think it depends to some extent on the duration of the problems. For example, if somebody comes in with a month's worth of nerve pain, like they're feeling very numb in their toes, it's tingly all the time, but it's only been going on for a month. A lot of the times, if I can bring their blood glucose down, those symptoms will reverse. This is true for early retinal changes as well. Like if they have just a few changes in their retinal exam, those will reverse with better glucose control. And even early changes in the kidneys, like small amounts of protein in the urine, can be reversed effectively with intense glucose control. It's the people that have been living with these these symptoms for a long period of time that are less likely to see full reversal of those problems, it will still be improved to some extent with intense glucose therapy control.
So you're going to still, by controlling and at least halting a progression, improve somebody's lifespan?
Absolutely, as well as morbidity. Like if somebody has really bad neuropathy, they put themselves at risk for infections of their toes or fingers and amputations. If somebody has really bad retinal problems, they put themselves at risk for blindness due to complications of that. And again, with kidney damage, you're of course putting yourself at risk for chronic kidney disease and failure and the complications that come from that.
Now, many people would be concerned about, oh, I have to go to insulin right away. First of all, there is a lot of support.
Mm-hmm.
Most areas have a diabetic clinic and staff, support staff.
Yeah, absolutely. So most, even primary care clinics will usually have the ability to meet with a nutritionist and go over the basics of how you should structure your diet, what components to include in every meal, how to break down the different meals of the day, and how much calorie restriction to implement. So that support definitely exists. And then when you go to specific diabetes clinics, there's a lot of ancillary staff. You see a physician, you see pharmacists that help you gauge the different, a system of drug coverage and what are your best options in terms of obtaining different drugs and are there programs that they can use to get, discounted rates for medications. Most diabetes clinics will also have certified diabetes educators that can help patients understand better how to manage their blood sugars and control it.
And most insurers are going to cover diabetic treatment?
Right. I think the cost of drug treatment is reducing, but it is still a problem. The population that tends to face a problem is obviously the Medicare group of people, as well as people whose private insurance is not offering very good prescription drug coverage. But that is improving rapidly over time. I hope it would improve faster. Insulin coverage is still an issue in terms of cost. And the bigger concern is, checking your blood sugar. The test strips tend to be expensive, but it is definitely something you can work with your physician on and see how to optimize it.
And if somebody says, well, I'm listening and I don't have a job at the moment, and I don't have health insurance, they shouldn't not get taken care of.
No. In fact, if you actually don't have a job and your income is lower than a certain limit, most clinics will be able to get you on some sort of financial aid system that will help you get the supplies you need.
Because it's not going to go away.
No, it's not.
And you're just going to get sicker and have more issues.
Yes, absolutely.
So we've explored diabetes, pre-diabetes. What else could we look at as a common endocrine issue?
So thyroid disease, I think, tends to get missed in men because the symptoms of thyroid disease can be very similar to that of low testosterone. And when men experience these symptoms, the first place their mind goes to is low testosterone because it's advertised so much. And then they might go and specifically ask their primary care doctor to check their testosterone level, but checking the thyroid might get missed. So the symptoms of thyroid disease, it can be one of two directions. Too little thyroid hormone can present with symptoms of fatigue, feeling very sleepy, feeling tired all the time. It can have cold intolerance, which is they feel cold all the time. They can also experience constipation and weight gain and a lot of dry skin. So if anybody experiences those symptoms, they should definitely ask their primary care doctor to check their thyroid level. On the other extreme end is also hyperthyroidism, which is too much thyroid hormone, which can present with, sort of this burst of energy, unable to fall asleep at night. They can feel warm all the time and flushed, they can feel palpitations, they can feel shaky or jittery, can feel extremely anxious, and also lose weight. So if people experience those symptoms, again, important to ask your primary care doctor to check your thyroid levels.
And would we assume that for a general yearly physical, at least some thyroid is getting screened?
So that's a very good question. So the USPSTF, which is the United States Preventive Services Task Force, does not recommend screening routinely for thyroid dysfunction. And the vast majority of primary care doctors are probably going to follow those guidelines and not be routinely screening for thyroid disease. However, if you look at the endocrine body, the American Thyroid Association actually recommends screening thyroid levels, or TSH, in everybody over over the age of 35. And the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, or ACE, recommends screening older people without an emphasis on what age to start at. I think in general, my practice has been that anybody who is over the age of 65, I will screen them for thyroid disease. But anybody else who has other risk factors, like if they have autoimmune conditions, like type 1 diabetes or vitiligo or Crohn's disease or celiac disease, those are people I would start screening even earlier, around age 35, and I would screen them every 5 years.
So thyroid disease is somewhat age-related?
It is age-related as well as it is autoimmune. So if it runs in your family, you are more likely to get it. If you have another autoimmune disease, you're more likely to get it. And the older you get, the more likely you are to get it.
And then treatment is if you're hypo, you get thyroid replacement?
Yep. It's sort of like taking a vitamin. It's a pill that you take every day. The dose could be very variable depending on the cause of low thyroid function and the degree of it. And if you have too much thyroid hormone, that can be treated in one of two ways. One is either pills, or there's also something called radioactive iodine therapy, where they give you sort of a radio-labeled iodine that you swallow as a pill, and it just kills off the cells in the thyroid gland that are making too much thyroid hormone.
And then you just go on replacement?
It depends sometimes on the cause. And the vast majority will end up on some replacement of thyroid hormone, and some people get away without any.
And it's well tolerated.
It's very well tolerated. And at the doses that are used for treatment of hyperthyroidism, there's really no concern that it would result in cancer or anything concerning.
Very treatable, good to find out about. And if left untreated?
That's an important point, especially as you get older. So untreated hyperthyroidism, that is too much thyroid hormone, which is not even to the level that the blood tests are frankly abnormal. They might just be subtly abnormal. That has actually been shown to increase your risk of both osteoporosis and atrial fibrillation in people over the age of 50. So the recommendation is that if you're over 50 years of age and you have a low TSH, even with a normal free T4, which is the thyroid hormone level, the recommendation is to consider treatment in anybody over the age of 50.
Nice. Now, we've talked about prediabetes, diabetes, thyroid. What else?
So osteoporosis is the other thing that I think we should discuss, because I think men tend to, again, not think about their bones as much. They don't worry that they're going to have a fracture, whereas it's so drilled into women that, you know, once you go through menopause, you're at risk for bone loss and you need to check on this. But the reality is, while the risk of osteoporosis is lower in men than in women, it isn't zero. And so especially as you get older, once you're over the age of 80, the risk goes up considerably. And as people are living longer and longer, over 80 is a significant chunk of the population. And having osteoporosis puts you at risk for having a fracture. And the fracture could be from something as simple as slipping on something and falling down and breaking your hip. And the problem with all of this is that when you have a fracture late in life, it puts you at high risk of death from that fracture and recovering from it. And so I think it's important to think about the people that I screen for osteoporosis. The men I screen for would include anybody who's on steroids, prednisone, for long periods of time. Anybody who's on it for more than 3 months really should be screened for osteoporosis and treated for it. So I'm talking people with rheumatoid arthritis or Sjogren's disease or lupus. Anybody with diabetes, I would screen for osteoporosis in their later life, because it does increase your risk of low bone density. And then men who have low testosterone, I would screen for osteoporosis. There are some people who are on normal doses of steroids like hydrocortisone for things like Cushing's disease, or have had pituitary surgery or traumatic brain injury and are on replacement. Even those people that we think we're giving normal levels of steroids to, I would still screen for osteoporosis. People with celiac disease or any absorption disorders, I would screen for osteoporosis.
And treatment?
The treatment for osteoporosis usually consists of drugs that are either infusions that you take once a year or pills that you take once a week. Again, very effective drugs that have been shown to reduce your risk of fractures considerably. The side effects of those, again, tend to get hyped online, but really they're most very well tolerated and the risks are not really something to worry about.
And I think I recall that if we maintain muscle mass and movement, helps maintain our bone health.
Absolutely. In fact, fact, if you look at the recommendations for daily activity, it includes not just cardio, but also resistance training. And that's extremely important for the bones, because the bones don't care so much about what the heart is pumping, but what the muscles around the bones are doing. And so it's very important to include weight training in part of your, as part of your workout regimen, especially the older you get. There's actually studies that have looked at CAT scans of people's muscle as they age, and the muscle component goes down drastically as you age. So the loss of muscle is very real, and it's definitely something to pay attention to.
Yeah, I remember a Stanford gerontologist who coined something as a term, a frailty scale.
Mm-hmm.
And people who were sedentary had a very steep slope into frailty.
Correct.
And so if you keep moving and maintain some muscle mass,
yep,
you're going to be much better off.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about testosterone. Now, we did an episode on testosterone, but you were nice enough to listen to it. So from an endocrinologist's point of view, what would you contribute on testosterone?
So I think most men are now aware of the existence of low testosterone and the need to treat it. And so they're watchful for the symptoms of low testosterone. But I think what people may not be quite aware of is the risk of developing low testosterone when you're on certain medications. And the two that come to mind for me are chronic steroids like prednisone and chronic narcotic therapy or opiates. With how many people do we now have on chronic narcotic prescriptions because of all sorts of pain syndromes, it's actually the prevalence of hypogonadism in these people is going up. And we don't always look to screen for them, for low testosterone in these people. A lot of the times their symptoms might be missed or, you know, overlooked. And so it's important to look at these individuals and screen them for a low testosterone. The other group that I think is important is any gentleman who presents with a fracture without a clear mechanism, like, or a clear cause of trauma, like, as I said, just, you know, slipped and fell down, broke a wrist or broke his ankle. I think those are people that we should consider screening for osteoporosis as well as low testosterone, because low testosterone is one of the single biggest risk factors for bone loss in men. And so they need to be screened for the presence of low testosterone as well.
And then we go on replacement and monitor.
Mm-hmm.
But there really are criteria for replacements, clinical and
Absolutely.
Laboratory.
Correct, yes. And I think the one of the problems is a lot of people come in with the idea, but this is low for me, and shouldn't this be more in the middle or the upper end of normal? And the reality is that's actually not true. So unless you've happened to check your testosterone level throughout your life and you know this is definitely lower than your baseline, there's no such thing as this is low for me. I think it's really correlation of low testosterone as well as the symptoms that makes the most sense to make this diagnosis. As you mentioned earlier, I do a lot of research in andrology, so we take a lot of healthy men in the age range of 18 to 30 who participate in our trials, and a lot of them have testosterone levels that are about 200 or 250 nanograms per deciliter, which would be considered low in a lot of cases, but these men are healthy and fine and virile and have no symptoms whatsoever. So I think this is something that is important for people to remember, that as the assays get more and more refined, the lab value cutoff change.
Other endocrine issues are more rare or mm-hmm. concerning, pituitary tumors, and anything that you want to go over in those? And
well, you know, I would say that whenever you see massive changes in your body in terms of weight distribution, or like you've had massive weight gain, that's something to probably at least talk to your doctor about and see if your primary care doctor feels it's important for you to meet with an endocrinologist, because you can get certain hormone excess, like excess growth hormone or excess cortisol production, that could present with changes like that. Anybody that is presenting to the hospital with inability to, you know, resolve an infection without the need of lots of medications in an ICU stay should be concerned about not enough cortisol. Those are very rare disorders, though. I don't think these are really something people need to have in the back of their mind on a day-to-day basis.
If somebody has an abrupt change, when their libido in a male who says, I used to be really, really interested in sex and just changed, there certainly can be screened.
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah. Any rapid change that you're noticing, definitely worth bringing up to your doctor.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then, since it's an interest of yours, talk about male contraception. Where are we as far as
So, you know, the joke in our group is that, you know, we've always been 5 to 10 years away from the next birth control method for men. The world of male contraception is very interesting. My personal area of focus is just hormonal male contraception, where we try to give men testosterone-like agents in the form of either an injection or a pill or a patch or a gel that they can apply. And then what it does is it gets absorbed into their blood and suppresses the production of hormones from the brain that then tell the testicles to stop making testosterone and sperm. But by virtue of this drug being present in their blood, it will act in place of testosterone and make them feel completely normal. This field has been researched over the last 40 to 50 years now. And though we have a lot of regimens that work effectively in the vast majority of men, the problem we've run into is making a regimen that is easy for men to use and also completely safe in terms of both side effects as well as what we would be consider safe in terms of changes in blood pressure or cholesterol changes. Currently, our group is actually working on a few different formulations that are novel androgens. So these are modifications of testosterone that have been made. One of them is called dimethandrolone undecanoate, and the other is called 11-beta-MNTDC. Both of these are being investigated as pills, so we're hoping that we could make the next male pill. But they're very early in the stages of development. They've pretty much just done phase one trials at this point. But it's promising in that they definitely suppress the hormones to the levels that we want to see, and they were very well tolerated by the men that took them. We obviously need to see longer studies before they go anywhere. But the agent that is actually furthest ahead right now is a combination gel. So it's a gel that consists of testosterone, which is an FDA-approved drug, but also has an investigational product called Nesterone, which is a progesterone-like agent. This is actually used in female birth control rings. It's never been used in men in long studies. There have been sort of 6-month-long studies that we have done in men that have shown that the drug works very well. It brings sperm counts down to zero. So right now, there is an efficacy study going on, which is we are recruiting couples where they will only use this drug as their birth control method, and we'll see how effective it is at preventing pregnancies. This is an ongoing study at the University of Washington, as well as multiple other sites throughout the world. We're hoping to complete this study within the next year or at the most 2, and then we should have results shortly after that.
And then you brought up an interesting point on testosterone as a birth control, but for young men who are listening, we want to make certain they don't go on testosterone if they want to be fertile.
Correct. So it isn't, the chance isn't zero, but you diminish your chance of being able to successfully father a pregnancy considerably with testosterone therapy. So that is an important discussion to have if you require testosterone therapy, because there are alternate agents that can be used in that situation.
Absolutely. Well, remind our audience of resources
Yes. That
are available. So let's go back to diabetes.
The American Diabetes Association website usually does have a lot of resources that you can be guided towards. The American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists also has a lot of resources that you can go to. So that's the ADA and the AACE websites. But, you know, Facebook has actually become a very good place. I have a lot of patients, especially with type 1 diabetes, who tell me that they find all these different groups about how to manage type 1 diabetes, how to use glucose monitors and things more efficiently, how to use their insulin pump. And I think these are amazing resources for people living with these problems nowadays. If you have type 1 diabetes, there's a lot of research studies that are ongoing about diabetes technology. Clinicaltrials.gov is a very good source to find what trials are ongoing. And definitely in Seattle, multiple locations that are doing a lot of research. There's also a lot of type 1 diabetes research that is in relatives of type 1 diabetes, so who do not yet have diabetes but are at risk for getting diabetes. And so the Benaroya Research Institute, or the BRI, is doing a lot of those trials.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Mullally, appreciate your time. This was wonderful.
Thank you very much.
This completes another podcast chapter of the Washington State Urology Society's original Guide to Men's Health. This is Dr. Richard Pellman reminding you to take care of yourself. The Washington State Urology Society wishes to thank all contributors who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The Society also wishes to thank Sean Fox for his invaluable technical assistance. Music theme, San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. Dave Weidig. The podcasts are the property of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the express consent of the Society is strictly prohibited. For more information about men's health, visit WSUS.org or visit your physician or care provider.